Morning, everyone, and it's Jeff again, so it's creation, not evolution again. Those of you who have heard me speak over the last few years on that subject, this is about number 15, I think. So, but it's different, I don't think you've heard this one. But the start's very much the same, because we as Christian Dolphins believe wholeheartedly in the Word of God, and we believe in the creation account. Just going back there, in the beginning God created, you know, right straight away. That's the challenge for the Bible reader. But if we go on, we have ever increasing confidence that God is the creator and God is in control despite the waywardness of man. And as you go through Genesis 1 and go through the days of creation, you come down and you come down to the fifth day. And in verses 20 to 21, we have a description of the creation of the birds and of the fish. And when you consider how many different birds there are in the world, how many different types of bird, and how many different types of fish there are, it's just incredible that God could do that. And we've just got two verses, that's all. Incidentally, I looked on the internet this morning on BBC News, and there was a little clip there, and there's a new octopus been discovered. Off California, so this life form's still yet to be discovered. And I'm highlighting verse 21, every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind. And the reason for doing that is, as I always do, I'm going to pick on one creature, and it's not a bird this time, it's fish. And as we look through this story of this fish, I hope we can see that there is a designer. Now I have to say, I can't explain why God chose to create such a fish. It's certainly something I would never have dreamt of, but then that goes for so many other different forms of life. It's God's choice, and it's not for me to explain why he chose and he's done it this way or that, but when we look through the life story of this fish, I think if you look at it without prejudice, you can't help but marvel and wonder and come to a conclusion there's greater mind than our own. Just before we leave that verse 21, you can see there, you know, what I've got highlighted in red. These creatures that are created such that they're after their kind. And it's just an indication there that God is saying that they're already been made so that they will reproduce. And in the reproduction, the next one will be exactly the same as the one that went before. And so there's succeeding generations of the same creature. It's not a case, as evolutionists would have it, of a developing creature over millions of years. Not that. God created this animal, this bird, this fish, whatever it is, and straight away, with the ability to reproduce, and it reproduces one of its own exactly after their kind. It's just a little phrase, but I think it's important. So a little bit of interaction with you now, but don't be shy, and I hope you're not too sleepy this Sunday morning. I'm not going to ask you too many questions, and just two or three at the beginning here before I really get going. So there, it's easy, and if the question I'm going to ask you proves to be difficult, I'll give you some helpful hints on the way. Simple question: what are these guys eating? Bright lot here. King's Norton, it was a little bit slower last week. Yeah, they are. They're eating jelly deals. Used to be very popular in the days of caps like that. I guess we're back in the 1920s or something with that photograph. But it wasn't unusual to see Londoners eating jelly deals. They seem to be enjoying theirs. But if you had difficulty noticing that they were eating eels, then I would have shown you this picture. And then I would have said, what creature are we going to talk about? And you all would have shouted out the otter. And I've said, no, we're talking about the eel. And if he didn't spot the eel, then we'd have come up with a third one. What's eating the eel on that one, incidentally?
Heron.
Grey heron. But you see, whether it's human being, otter, heron, eels, nice food. I have to say, I've never eaten eel. I don't actually fancy it. Question: how many eaten eels, jellied or otherwise? Brian, you say, now I understand Brian at the moment in London, it's very much an expensive dish. And there are people making money, probably taking your money, I don't know. So one of us has eaten meal. And before I go any further, how many of you, and this is a question for the ladies, but I suspect the lads probably likely to come forward more. Anyone caught an eel fishing? I'm looking at, I knew Dean. I looked straight at Dean. I thought, Dean's the one. I can see him there by the canal. You caught more than one?
No, I've never caught one.
Oh, that's all right. That's one more than me. I've never caught an eel. Kenny? One? A few? You don't have to give me the exact number.
Well, it was 50-something years ago with my Irish granddad who used to go out fishing. Eels.
Was that in Dublin by any chance?
Yes,
probably. There you go. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, very good. Well, I've got to say, I've only ever seen two or three eels, and it's similar time which was Kevin in my teens, which is a long time ago. I did a bit of fishing for a while, and I was really pleased I never caught an eel because I could see from the lads that caught them, they really were slippery and slimy, and they had teeth, and they seemed to be a real pain to get off the line. Is that right?
Yeah,
you're going to agree with me anyway, thank you. So I was quite happy just to catch the occasional chub, and on a bad day a little gudgeon. But anyway, I never caught an eel, but I've seen eels, and I didn't like the look of them very much. And it's an eel we're talking about today. I hope that's not going to put you off, because the story of the eel is fascinating. I'm going to take you back now to 1923. You know, this is within 100 years. A Danishman by the name of Johan Schmidt wrote this paper to the Royal Society, highly esteemed establishment, as I'm sure you understand, among scientists. He wrote this journal, and I'm going to show you a passage, and his English is quite interesting. It's almost old-fashioned English. I don't know his education in Denmark. He was brought up solely in the English lessons on Shakespeare or something, but it's interesting language. But I think we can understand what he's saying. It's quite interesting. We know then, he says, we know then that the old eels vanish from our ken into the sea. And that sea sends us in return innumerable hosts of elvers. But whither have these wandered, these old eels? And whence have the elvers come? And what are the still younger stages like, which precede the elver stage in the development of the eel? It is such problems that constitute the eel question. And what he's saying is, and especially in the 1920s and the early years of that century, you went fishing, riverbank, canal side, whatever, you would catch an eel fairly easy. It's more difficult these days, there's not so many of them, but that's another story. You'd see an eel like that, and then they said, you know, we know that they, at some point in their life history, they go out toward the sea. They're determined to go out to the ocean, and they disappear. We don't see the life cycle of the eel until we see at the beginning of spring, we see little things, and these are the elvers that are in the hands here, until we get elvers. And they're going the other way. As the big eel was determined to go out toward the sea, leaving the river, so these little creatures are coming in from the sea and determined to go up river. What happens in between? That's the eel question. And the question has been resolved in large measure now, has to be said, but there are still one or two other mysteries, as I'll show you as we go along. But in 1923, people didn't have much idea at all, really. But this Johan Schmidt made it his life's work for a year or two. But before I talk a little bit more about him, I'm going to go back a stage to this French zoologist in 1886, Yves Delage, who discovered, and I'm going to use the word in brackets here, flathead, which is much more comfortable for me. He discovered that the flathead was not a species of ordinary fish, but a young eel. There's these little fish in the Mediterranean, and he discovered that these little fish in the Mediterranean, commonly called the flathead, actually turn into eels. Now, no one had noticed that before, What he did, he kept specimens of those alive in a tank in the lab, and as the days turned into weeks and so on, he noticed that the leaf-like two-inch creature that he caught in the med, eventually, given time, grew into something recognisable as an eel. And this was so astonishing, it took until 1893 before anyone believed him. Poor chap. It took him 7 years before anyone actually said, yeah, okay, we agree with you, that's what's going on. So this is more or less where our friend Johann Schmidt comes in, because he decided in the 1920s to trace the origins of these little flatfish, the flathead I should say, as far as he could. And he discovered that as you went out to sea into the Atlantic and he went further and further west, so they grew big, they went smaller. He went as far as the Sargasso Sea, which is south of Bermuda. And there it is, not a great picture. Incidentally, it's one of these sort of trivial quiz questions that's handy to have up your sleeve, or you might have to answer it one day. The Sargasso Sea is the only sea without a coastline. Just one of those little things. But there you are, the Sargasso Sea. He went right over to there. And in going over there, as I say, as he made his progress and took samples of this fish, they got smaller and smaller and smaller. And he identified that the Sargasso Sea must be the most likely spawning grounds. Now, he didn't find any eggs, and no one's found any eggs yet. I'll say that again, no one's found any eggs yet. So he went to the Sargasso Sea, and he started taking measurements and so on, but in the green there is where the eel, the small eels, baby eels, if you like, start to move from the Sargasso Sea back towards Europe and towards the British Isles, where our interest comes in. And there you are, we've got the Atlantic there shaded in different colours, representing the different sizes of the fish. You can see how he came to that conclusion. And this is an open question now. Does it take them 1 year to get to the British Isles, or does it take as much as 3 years? Obviously, it depends on currents and so on. But nevertheless, it's amazing that these little fish managed to find their way 3,000 miles in that direction, taking 1 to 3 years. But eventually, they hit our shorelines, and we have something which I think is magical. I've never seen this. I'd love to see this. Something called glass eels. And they're beautiful. They might be terribly slimy, but there they are. They're glass eels, and they come in onto the continental shelf during the early spring, so it's probably about to happen. Maybe a wee bit early at the moment, but in the next week or two, it's going to start to happen. And this fish is now not a flat head at all. It's changed shape. It's gone cylindrical. And because of the transparency, they're commonly called at that point glass eels. And the thing about the eel, and as you go through its life cycle, so the name of it changes, it's different names. So at this point, it's a glass eel. And I particularly like that one I found on the internet. Do you like that, or is it just me? You know, for something that's colourless, it catches your eye, doesn't it? And talking of the eye, look at the eye on that fish. Fantastic. There's a wonder in that. Now, I don't think this is all of chance, of forces colliding this way and that way by strange circumstance on some matter. This is a creature created, designed. And these glass eels, they go to estuaries, some stay in the estuaries and develop only there, but the vast majority of them keep on going upstream. There's a drive within them, and they have to keep going upstream. And it's been noticed that they swim in the upper layers during flood tide, and by keeping to the bottom during ebb tide, they make progress. don't know how they worked that out, but somehow they did. And they will go over all the natural challenges that present themselves, and they'll pile up upon each other, you know, thousands, nay, millions, you know, over and over. You can see their horrible mess now. It doesn't look quite too attractive, I don't think. Wriggling mess. But they're just determined to go upward, and they'll go over each other, and they'll go over anything to do it. And one of the reasons why eels are not so popular now is that there are man-made obstacles that prevent their progress, sadly, and there's also pollution. They can propel themselves over wet grass. They don't have to be in water. Wet grass, they'll dig through wet sand, and they'll just keep driving on. Now, in 2014, volunteers, you know, people, you know, almost every creature that's diminishing numbers has friends somewhere. There's a society or a group that sets about trying to preserve them. But even the eel has got a little group of volunteers working. And these volunteers estimated that 2 million elvers, or thereabouts, they helped the river Parrot in Dorset, and moved them up past the barriers, helped them on the way. And then the growth. They grow real quick, and that glass transparency unfortunately gets darker. They get a dark pigment, they go brown of colour. And the growth is affected by temperature. In northern waters, the eel grows slower than, say, it would do in the Med. But they grow, and a large females tend to be bigger, in old money up to 5 foot. Now, I'm tempted to ask Dean and Kevin here to say how big their eels are, but we could have a bit of an argument here, you know. I think if you get an eel, you know, something like 2.5 foot 3, probably that's typical. But there you are, they've come a long way from being a little tiny little thing in the Sargasso Sea. And they reckon a male live for about 6 or 7 years, and a female for 10 or 12 years, so they're quite long living. But there's some mysteries on this too, they really are. And I had a bit of fun researching this. There are some eels that just stay in forgotten pools or lakes, ponds, and they know they're 25, 30, even 40 years old. But it's more exciting than that. In captivity, we've had eels that are 85 years old, and I looked on the internet site, and a couple of years ago there was an eel that died, and it was quite famous in Sweden, because it was the bottom of a well, and it was reckoned to be 155 years old. Oh, that's a bit of a Hans Christian Andersen or something. I'm sorry, it's from Denmark. But anyway, I don't know. Bit of a fairy story, but there is mystery even in their lifespan. Certainly they can live a long time. Now, this is an amazing paragraph. I'm sorry, it's quite a bit to read through, but this is an amazing paragraph I'm putting before you. In large densities, such as those traditionally found in the River Severn, Wye, Parrot, which all drain into the Bristol Channel, the majority of glass eels, or elvers as they become, remain male. But where densities are low, such as the rivers on the east coast of England, like the Suffolk Stour, many change from male to female to improve the odds of successful spawning. Now hang on a minute, you know, I'm putting that in red. What is going on there? Now, an eel doesn't have fully developed reproductive organs until it gets back to the Sargasso Sea. So, for all the circle all the way around, those reproductive organs are in a stage of development. And what's been said is that where there's a high density of eel, you know, things that start off in such a way that an eel potentially looks like it's going to go into a male, and so it goes. But where there's not so many eels, such as on the east, then those eels that look in the early stage of their life to be developing into males switch and they start developing as a female. Now, I have a big problem with evolution anyway, on the basis of the sexes. I mean, it's an incredible happy circumstance to have anything evolving from one single cell, and that's incredible in itself as a cell. Nothing simple about it, although at school 50 years ago, it was a simple cell. Oh boy, I hope they've learned a bit more since then. But I'll just use that little phrase for a moment. You take a simple cell, from that we get a human being. But then a male and a female, completely different in the reproductive sense, and yet they have to come together and be compatible. That's amazing. And that happens over and over and over again in so many different life forms. I know there are some creatures where the distinction between male and female is not vital, but in so many, the vast majority, there's a male that's completely different to a female in that regard, and yet they've got to be compatible. There's a wonder in that. How do evolutionists explain that? That all the throws of the dice that way, and all the throws of the dice go that way, and yet that comes in beautifully to work. Well, they've got a bigger problem here, because these eels change from being, in all likelihood, a male to a female. I marvel at that. I wonder at that. How do they know? They don't know. It's all ordained of God. They've all been programmed to behave in this way. And so I, like those faithful ones in the book of Nehemiah, so thou, even thou art Lord alone, thou hast made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their host, the earth, and all things that are therein, the seas, and all that is therein, and thou preservest them all, and the host of heaven worshipeth thee. That's enough. If I knew nothing else about the eel, that would be enough for me. God is in control. I may not have chosen to do things quite like that. It wouldn't have been my idea. But God has chosen that this creature should behave and develop in this way. And it does so wondrously, majestically. Now, in September or October time, something like that, I think it's commonly agreed, usually after rain, when the moon's overcast, and there's a debate on that, because you go and read some old chap out in the out in Cambridgeshire or somewhere like that over in the east, and he'll write a little story about him catching eels for the last 50, 60, 70 years, and he'll say, ah, the moon has to be full, and I mean, it's a full moon the eels go on the move. So there's a bit of debate on this one, but from the internet I lifted off this sentence. These are not my words, somebody else commenting on the eel. In September, October, usually after rain, and everyone's agreed on that, when the moon's overcast, they get the call. No one's defining what that is. No one's defining what that is, but they get the call. And no one knows why. And what we mean by that is that these eels that may have been in an estuary, in a river, in a lake, in a canal, might be in Dublin or wherever it was. Then where was it?
East Anglia drains.
In the drains, man-made drains of East Anglia, wherever they be. Not all of them, of course not. Not all of them, but some of them, whether they're 7 years old, 8 years old, 10 years old, 20 years old, whatever they are, we've got to move, and they start moving. And they're moving away from fresh water to seawater. Destiny? Destination? You can tell me, can you remember the name?
Sargasso Sea.
And it was our Danish scientist, Mr. Schmidt, that come up and found that out. It took to 1922, 23 for him to find it. Before then, 100 years ago, nobody had a clue. Well, there are little forms of these eels in the Mediterranean, and they just thought they were like other fish. And how about this for a bit of information? Due to their rigid gill structure, silver eels, by this time, when they start moving out of the freshwater situation, they become silver. I'll talk about that in a moment. They're called silver eels. Their gills are such that they can seal water in, and they can survive out of water for 12, even up to 48 hours. They can be 2 days out of water and survive. And so they go over land. Staggering. Up to 2 days. You've got to have a special gill structure for that to work. That gill structure, sophisticated, designed, created, thought out, planned before. Not of them, but of the Creator. So I've highlighted those little phrases in colour there. Staggering story, really. And these fish that are now moving, let's just go back a bit, sorry. They haven't got a digestive system anymore. Before they make that move, the digestive system is dissolved. And they're just relying on the stored energy they've got, of the fat they've got of themselves, for the next weeks, months. No stomach. Incredible. And as for their eyes change. Eye pigments change from optimal vision in dim blue, clear ocean light. In other words, it's one thing seeing in fresh water, even in a dark, murky, stagnant pool, but it's another thing in fresh water, in seawater, in the sea, the open ocean. So their eyes change. Their eyes get bigger. And they change. Perhaps Josh can explain that to me a bit later on. I don't know. And there's a picture. Ellen said it wasn't very good, but it's the best I could do, unfortunately. At the top, you've got the yellow eel, which is the sort of eel you'd be catching in the rivers. The silver eel is when the eel was about to, is on the move. It's leaving the rivers. And you might be able to see that the eye is bigger. And it's changed colour a bit, but it's not very good, and it's not very good on that screen, sadly. It's better on my screen. They also have counter shading pattern on their bodies, so it makes it difficult for predators to pick them out in the sea. So they change their colour, they've lost their stomach, their eyes change. And mark this well, I mentioned it three, four weeks ago, I don't know when it was, when I spoke about the salmon here a few weeks ago. You just imagine the situation. You've got a creature that lives in fresh water, and now it's got to survive in seawater. Now, I kept tropical fish for a good few years, I know one or two you have. There was no way you would buy a marine fish and put it in a freshwater tank, would you? And I went through that scenario, and I talked about the salmon, as I said, a few weeks ago. There's got to be a lot of changes there to cope with the salt levels, the density, and all the rest of it. There's a wonder in that. And so, they reckon it takes at least 6 months for these eels to swim 3,720 miles, we'll forget about the 20 miles, it's all rough figures obviously, 3,700 miles to their spawning ground. Now, it's about 3 years ago, they put some trackers on eels. It's been an exciting time actually the last few years with technology, because in the last few years they've been able to put trackers on cuckoos, and I've talked about that I'm sure here, and so they've been able to trace the migration of cuckoos, and they've learned a lot. And so they thought of doing this with eels too. And they actually put trackers on eels. I think it was Sweden. I think the Swedes did it. But anyway, it was always thought that these eels, once they hit the sea and they're out, would go more or less in a straight line across. After all, they've got to go thousands of miles. So you can't dilly-dally go this way, that way. You've got to be pretty direct, you would think, and take a short route across. Or the shortest route across. But with these trackers, in the last handful of years, they have discovered, actually, amazingly, and to everybody's surprise, no, they go due south, and they go down the African coast, they go down off the Azores, and then they pick up what's called the conveyor belt ocean current. And so getting into that current, they get swept along quicker than they can swim, over. But it still takes them 6 months. And so the point is, and put it in red, they go by the most efficient route rather than the shortest. Now, how could they possibly work that out? And how could that possibly come about by chance? Evolutionists expect us to believe this is all happening by chance. It might take millions of years, lots of various mutations and a lot of sadness and woe on the way, but somehow some of them come through and behave like, no, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. It's much easier, seems to me, to believe there is a designer, there is a creator, has planned it all out, and knows full well there's a conveyor belt ocean current there, and those fish are going to use them. Incidentally, before I just finish off a little bit on the cyclone, because the sort of thing you forget, the eel's the only fish that can swim backwards. And also the eel can change its head shape. So it changes its body a number of times, you know, flat head, and then we get the cylindrical type eel type thing. But the head itself, they can change it so they can make it flattened out or they can make it rounded. The reason for that is that according to how the seabed is, or the riverbed, I should say, really, the riverbed, you know, they can hoove up on the floor or they can burrow down. And they can have their head of one shape for 6 months, 2 years maybe, and then change it another way. There's a whole range of scientists working on that, how they do that. So a lot of science going on, just trying to find some of these answers to these mysteries. Anyway, that digression aside, they go the most efficient route rather than the shortest. And then they found this out. And this has got people scratching their heads. They spend a lot of time and energy moving vertically in the water. During the day, they might swim as deep as 1.2 kilometres or 3/4 of a mile. Then they come up to about 200 metres or 655 feet at night. That behaviour is likely to be connected with navigation and the avoidance of predators. But it also suggests that exposure to a range of temperatures is linked to the process of maturing. Do you remember that business I was saying about their reproductive organs? They reckon there might be something to do with that, the temperature changes. The truth of it is they don't know why they do it. But let's just pause for a minute. How many of you have been scuba diving? There we go. Kevin, what's that place near you where they do...
Stony Cove.
Stony Cove. They have all the clobber on and all the rest of it. Yeah? I'd like to have a chat with some of those guys, as with Sam and those who put the rounds up there. It's deep as 3/4 of a mile. And then, hey, we'll go up. It's getting dark. We go up to the top. Why do they do that? They're going 3,700 miles. Why do they make it hard for themselves and they're going up and down like that all the way? It's ridiculous. That's what they do. Now, tough question for you now. And don't tell me a whale, because that's not good enough. What type of whale is that?
Is it a minke whale?
I'm really glad you had a go, Marty.
Beluga.
But no.
Bowhead.
No, we'd be here all day. It's a murderous question, that, really. I wouldn't have a clue. It's actually a short-finned pilot whale. There are actually, in other parts of the world, there are long-finned pilot whales. But these are short-finned pilot whales, and guess where they live?
Sorry, Ossetia.
Nearly. Off the west coast of Africa. And do you remember those Cockney boys that were eating the jellied eels? And you remember the otter that was eating the eel? And you remember the heron that was eating the eel? They've just found out in the last 3 or 4 years, thanks to the tracking devices, that short-finned pilot whales, they love eating eels. And there's some of those whales swimming about off the African coast with trackers in them. I don't know if they're learning a lot about short-finned whales now, pilot whales now. But, you know, it's funny, really. It's funny. Just found that out. That is new. So the eel, it's got a tough life, really. Everyone's against it, it seems. And although in days gone by in this country, people used to eat a lot more eels. So if you go back to the Middle Ages, for instance, it seems like it was almost a staple diet. for a lot of places in the country, the cities and East Anglia and so on. And I know from my experience in Ireland, and those of us have been over to Ireland, where, you know, our Blood Brothers and Sisters are there, and Waterford and Passages, they used to catch loads and loads of eels all the time. They're eels. And today, the Dutch like eels a lot. Eels are eaten in Holland. The Japanese eat lots of eel. But days gone by, it was almost a staple diet in the Middle Ages in Britain. And so, otters are partial to eels and herons and whales. But days gone by, make no mistake, been a vital food source for man. Right, a little summary. There's the cycle. And for that cycle to go all the way around, it's going to need 8 years minimum, but probably 20 for a lot of them. You know, we're talking a long time, a whole circle round, a long time, years. It takes years for that to go around. And when those eels get to the Sargasso Sea, and the spawning takes place and so on, that's the end of that eel. That's where they die. So they're brought into being in the Sargasso Sea. And if man, heron, whale, whatever doesn't intervene, that's where they die. Right where they started. Of course, it starts to cycle off the next generation for 10 years or 20 years, how long it'll be. Truly remarkable. I'll leave you with this quote. Now, Richard Shelton apparently is a top biologist looking into the fisheries industry, and he made that quote. It is senseless to spawn in the sea where there are more predators and then feed in fresh water where there's less food. Well, that may well be his opinion. That may well be his opinion. He, of mighty learning and great qualification, that might be his opinion. That's not the way it is with respect to the eel. The eel does exactly that. And to be truthful with you, if it wasn't for man, we'd be thriving really well. Fantastic. Now, this morning I've just talked about an eel. I haven't seen one for 950 years. There's only one person who's ever eaten an eel. And there's only a couple of you caught eels. And we can go away and just forget about it. And fair enough. It's been mildly entertaining what I've been saying. But God cares. All his creatures are all watched over. And there's a wonderful interaction between ebb and flow, current and tide, bird and beast, fish and man, all that, all interacting, all ever going. As I'm speaking now, the reel's moving. Even very tiny little glass eels are moving. All of God, all known of him. But an eel is nothing compared to a human being. Just consider, just briefly, because I've spoken a long time, just bear with me for a minute. The wonder of it, of all the cells that make up a human body, and there are lots of different cells that make up the human body, lots of different types. I just find it amazing that the largest of all human cells is the female egg, which is just about visible from the eye, but the female egg is the largest. And the small, all the different cells that make up the human body, all the cells, the smallest, and it can't be seen by the naked eye, is the sperm cell. Just a simple fact. But it leaves me in awe. And there's no scientist on the planet can tell you how many cells make up the human frame. You can test it on the internet. They say trillion this, trillion that. I know it's a lot. But human being, we are wondrous, wondrous creatures. Blessed with so much greater capacity to develop, even to understand the ways of God. as wondering eel enough to realise there is a God. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. O Lord, how manifold are thy works! In wisdom hast thou made them all. The earth is full of thy riches.